Good evening and welcome back to lesson six of our awesome course, My God. I'm excited for tonight, although I'm a little sad that it's the last session of this course. I was having a great time. I hope all of you were as well. And tonight we are going to be discussing four final questions of our 25 at least that we covered. Namely, tonight we're going to be addressing number one, why can't we see God? Why can't we see God? Number two, can we reconcile God with science? Number three, why is Judaism so obsessed with idolatry? Is God jealous? And finally, I'm a spiritual person. Why do I need to follow the Torah's system to have a relationship with God? Can I just be spiritual and not religious? Why is that not okay? Before we jump in, I'm going to open with a little cute video. Instead of me telling a joke, we're going to do a short little video. And I have a feeling that you're going to prefer the video than another joke for me.
No,
I'm not.
Okay, ready?
Give us both.
To one night, I asked, I know God made us, but who made God? Mommy said, go to sleep, Gracie, ask a rabbi. The night, I was crying in my room when she shut the door. Rabbi, I'm never gonna see a rabbi. The next day, we were in the supermarket and we saw him. And I was like, excuse me, are you a rabbi? And he was like, actually, I am. I asked him, well, who made God? He said, that's a very big question for such a little girl. Then he invited us to his house for Shabbat. And the rest is history.
She's adorable.
Okay. Good choice, right? So with that, we will advance right into tonight's lesson, our relationship, and question number one, why can't we see God? Okay. Pretty straightforward question, I think, and pretty self-explanatory, right? Everyone knows that seeing is believing. If that's the case, if we're trying to always struggling and grappling with our faith in God and to believe in God, why don't we just have the opportunity to see God and then it's going to be all over. Everything will be wonderful. We won't have to doubt. We won't have to question. We won't have to struggle. So why doesn't God just not make himself visible to us? Now, let's just take this question all the way to its natural conclusion. And that is, let's say that I can muster up all the powers endowed within me as a rabbi and everything else. And I would be able to have you experience seeing God. Let me ask you, what would God look like if you were given and granted this opportunity to see God? Question on page 172 in your books. What would the experience of seeing God look like? What exactly do you imagine that you'd see? Please share. Don't worry about sounding crazy, because it is.
I don't know, energy, light.
Energy, light.
Power.
Good looking.
I don't imagine seeing God, but just the effects of him. You know, of things, incredible, beautiful things in our lives. You know, when your child is born, that's like God, a miracle.
Okay, so you're saying not really seeing God, but like seeing a manifestation or a miracle or something like that. Anybody else? What would such an experience look like?
I think he might look like us.
Okay. You're created in God's image. I hear you. So
But it would be awesome.
Whatever it would be awesome. I would assume so, yes. I would go with that. So, on a basic level, the reason why we can't see God is because we can't see God. God doesn't have a body, doesn't have an image, he's not physical, and there is nothing to see. If we would see God, we would know it isn't God, basically. Maimonides, I think we've already quoted from his 13 principles of faith. Principle number 3 is right here in text number 1. And I will ask Nick to please read that text for us.
The third principle is the negation of possessing corporeality. We believe that the one God of whom we speak is neither a body nor a bodily faculty. All activity that transpires with a body, such as motion, rest, or lodging, does not relate to him, neither in his essence nor in his doings.
Got it? Okay, thank you. So there are a lot of things. There are a lot of things that we really can't see. We can't see anger. We can't see a smell. We just can't see them. And this, of course, is one of those things. To be able to suggest that one could see God is nonsense, because there's nothing for the physical eye to see altogether when we're talking about God. So, as I said, if we did see God, we would know for certain that it isn't God, because God is not seeable. So that's for sure. That's a given. Let's continue with a reading by Dr. Irving Block, who was a Chabadnik, but also a Harvard professor. Let's hear what he has to say. Linda, could you please read text number 2 for us on page 174? So you're saying that if you would see God, you would see God on a throne. You're suggesting. So we talk about the throne of glory. That's not God.
Such evidence look like. Hansen describes it for us. The heavens open, the clouds pull apart, revealing an unbelievably immense and radiant Zeus-like figure towering up above us like 100 Everests. He frowns darkly as lightning plays across the features of his Michelangeloid face. Then he points down at me and exclaims for every man, woman, and child to hear, I have had quite enough of your clever logic chopping and word watching and theology. Be assured in our hands and that I know certainly exist. Keep going.
Mm-hmm.
The first question one has to ask is, if it is God himself, this is an ideal basic thesis of monotheism, that God is not a finite figure and has a visible form. No one raised in this tradition of suppose that a Zeus-like figure could be a manifestation of God, much less God himself. An ancient Greek might, but Hansen was not addressing himself to an audience of ancient Greeks. He was speaking to modern man, and this man, be he theist or atheist, if he looked up in the sky and saw Hansen a Zeus-like figure, would first of all be frightened out of his wits. Secondly, he might think Earth was being invaded by outer space creatures. If this figure proclaimed that he was God, only an imbecile would believe it. Probably the last thing one would think is that this is a manifestation of God.
Okay, thank you. So, what would it look like to see God? The third principle is the negation of God possessing corporeality. So, God isn't physical. The notion of seeing him is therefore nonsensical. So we would think that the question is answered and it's resolved. Why don't we see God? Because you can't see God. However, there's more to it. There's more to it because seeing goes beyond just the physical eye. If I say something to you and you say, oh, I see, do you mean that you see it with your physical eye? No, you mean you're referring to the fact that you perceive the idea with your mind's eye. So perhaps when we talk about seeing God, maybe we should be able to, with our perception, maybe with our mind's eye, we should be able to see God. So to see, as the dictionary tells us, actually has another meaning beyond just perceiving by the eye, is to perceive or detect as if by sight. So seeing isn't only physical. Why can't we perceive God if this perhaps is a different option of how we would be able to see God? So this question is a little more troubling. We can't just write it off like the other one of sight with our eye, because there are actually many people who did see God in this option of perceiving God with their mind's eye. And we'll take a look at text 3a and 3b, and we'll see exactly when it happened. Events that all of us are familiar with. Colin, would you like to read 3a, please?
A human king arrives in a province accompanied by his inner circle. He's preceded and followed by legions of soldiers. Yet, because he is human, like all others, everyone asks, which one is the king? However, when God is revealed, God permits, there is no need to ask for anyone to ask, which one is the king? When we see him, that we will recognize him and will proclaim him, this is my God, I will glorify him.
Okay, so we're told that at the time of the splitting of the sea, all of us perceive godliness. And we actually say this verse in our prayers every day, Ze Keli Ve'anveyu. Perhaps the name of the course is actually derived from this verse. This is my God. Everyone was able to identify God and was able to see God with their perception. A few weeks after this event, in 3b, Lou, could you please read that for us? This is a verse out of Exodus.
God said to Moses, tell the children of Israel, you have seen that I spoke with you from the heavens.
Thank you. And we already learned in one of our earlier lessons that many people throughout our history had an experience of seeing God. There were many prophets in our history who were able to see God. And what we just spoke about, the event of the revelation on Mount Sinai, everybody was able to see God. And uniquely, Judaism is the only religion that is based upon an event that is said that everybody was there and experienced it. Other religions are based on one person saying, I had a revelation, and they shared it with other people. So everyone had to believe one person in order for those other religions to be able to take off, so to speak. And however, when it comes to Judaism, no individual came and said, I had a revelation, everyone has to buy my story. Judaism says that all, whatever the number is, roughly 3 million people, all witnessed the revelation at Mount Sinai. Everybody was there. And everyone who was there shared it with their children, and then with their grandchildren, and so on and so forth, till today. So it was never based on one person's story. You can't make up a story and say everybody was there and have millions of people actually buy into it, if it's a lie. It's not possible to claim that everybody was there and then not be true. You wouldn't be able to make such an argument, and it wouldn't fly. You would have some people questioning it, and maybe even many people, probably the majority of people, denying it and rejecting it. But that's not what happened. Everybody experienced it. In other words, everyone at the time had an experience of perceiving godliness. So if they saw God, and they, again, this is the other definition of seeing, then why don't we, or why can't we? So, here's the thing. So now we strengthened our question, and based on the fact that many people have seen God, the entire Jewish nation at the Red Sea, at Mount Sinai, and individuals through prophecy, as we discussed in an earlier lesson during this course. So let me ask you, we all know, yes?
It's perceived seeing.
Meaning they saw God with their perception. Just like when you say, oh, I see, something becomes clear to you. Something becomes very obvious to you. You don't need to be convinced about it anymore. It's just you have clarity on it because you just perceive it. There are certain things that you know, in Yiddish, it's called an upleg. Upleg is like an intuition or maybe conviction that you just know it. You just feel it, that that's how it is, that that's what it is. Every single Jew who was at the splitting of the sea or revelation at Mount Sinai had absolutely no question if they perceived God. It was clear that they did, and as I mentioned in a previous class, that every average Joe, any member of the Jewish people, every single one saw godliness beyond what the prophet Ezekiel saw. So it was clear to them. So if that's the case, we ask again, why can't we see God or perceive God? So, yes, Shelley.
At Sinai, when they, quote, perceived God, did they also hear God, not just perceive they heard him, they actually heard him?
They certainly heard because they heard the commandments. Question, there's some debates if they heard only the first two from God or all 10, there's different opinions, but they certainly heard, they heard the voice of God. I'm not going to go off on this, but at Mount Sinai, they actually saw what's normally heard and heard what's normally seen.
But it says, isn't hearing something more powerful than actually, quote, perceiving? Because you couldn't really see God.
Well, hearing something is not as strong as seeing something with your eyes. When you see something, then it's absolute. Nobody could question it. Nobody can convince you otherwise. When you're hearing it, so you're taking it in with your mind. So you can understand it this way. Then maybe somebody else can convince you of an opposite argument. So if their perception was as if they were seeing it, then that would be more powerful, perhaps, than hearing. So, where are we? Okay, here we are. So, we're going to do something Jewish. So we have to answer this question. So how do Jews answer a question?
With a question.
With a question, exactly. So, if somebody says, why can't I see God? Let me ask you, why do you even want to see God? If you do. Assuming that you have such a desire, why?
Validate.
Curious.
To validate our faith or our belief. Okay.
Curious.
You're curious. Okay. Anyone else?
I think it would affirm what you think is right.
Okay. Okay.
I believe it would make 100% there'd be no doubt.
So what you're saying is, basically, that it would be much easier to believe in God and to follow the Torah and to follow God's commandments because there wouldn't be that struggle. You would know for sure that he exists, you saw him, and yes?
Until Moses is introduced, actually, I guess the burning bush, followed up by the splitting of the sea and Revelation and so on. God is talked about as communicating, not someone seeing something, evidence or perception of sight. Abraham hears God, Adam hears God, but there's nothing in Genesis that talks about seeing evidence of God until you get to the burning bush, which is also a physical manifestation of God, not God.
And yeah, but to Abraham, it does say that God appeared to Abraham. Vayera Elav Hashem is God appeared. If somebody is appearing, then you would think that the other party is seeing what's going on. And that term is beyond just Abraham. I'm just thinking of the opening of the Parsha Vayera, which is God appearing to him after his circumcision. So yes, we do have that. Although maybe actual seeing, the actual term seeing is more in Exodus about Moses. First of all, everybody saw. We just quoted the verse that said, all of you saw.
Well, we saw the manifestation. We saw the physical, whatever it was that God did.
Well, God himself said these words. Tell the children of Israel, you have seen that I spoke with you from the heavens. This is God following up after revelation. Later on, God says to Moses, you will see my back, not my face. So we do see the term. So the answers we are gathering here of why anyone would even want to see God seems to be because it would be much easier to believe and then to serve God. But the truth is that if we did experience seeing God, yes, it would be a very uplifting experience, it would be a very inspiring experience, but as we know, it wouldn't necessarily guarantee our commitment or devotion to God at all. Because what happens 40 days after the Jewish people received the Torah at Mount Sinai?
It was a little golden
40 calf. Days after the Sinai revelation, the Jews worshiped the golden calf. What does that say for seeing God and experiencing revelation? It didn't last more than 40 days, and a large number of Jews were worshiping the golden calf. So why is that? Why is that the case? They saw God, whatever anyone could ask for, the greatest revelation one could ask for, and yet it didn't last more than 40 days.
Did people die during that time and actually came back to life? Some were so shocked that they died on the spot.
You mean at revelation?
Yeah.
It does say that their souls expired and then were restored. So yes, it was clearly an awe-inspiring experience. So the thing is like this, that when we experience something, something wow, something awesome, it's not that we are experiencing it. We are being overwhelmed by an experience. It doesn't mean that we are actually absorbing and integrating or taking in that particular experience. It means that it is taking us over. It's overwhelming us. And that was true at the time of the revelation of Mount Sinai. Of course it was awesome. There was never anything like it, and there will never be anything like it. But yet, on whose terms was it? It was on God's terms. God just revealed himself. The people weren't necessarily, so to speak, ready to receive that revelation, nor were they able to absorb it and take it in a way that it should be long-lasting. Let me ask you something else. Have you ever heard of, by the raise of hand, did you ever hear of a Jewish-like trip or retreat that was going to visit Mount Sinai?
No.
No? How about the Temple Mount in Jerusalem? Or the Kotel, or the site of the Temple Mount in Jerusalem?
Yes.
All the time.
Yeah.
What's the difference? Imagine that the place where the Torah was given and revealed.
People
and
know where Mount Sinai is, for sure.
Maybe there isn't a certainty, but is there a general idea? I think so, right? But yet, you don't see anybody, there's no search or longing to be able to visit that site. Why is it? What's the difference? And that's because the site of Mount Sinai, where the Torah was given, that was God's doing. It came down from above to below, and the people didn't do anything. As soon as the event was over, God's glory parted from that space, and there was basically the holiness left it. There isn't anything to go back for. However, when it comes to the Temple Mount, where the temple stood in Jerusalem, thousands of Jews flocked there all the time. You know why? Because that was the people's doing. The people themselves created the holiness of the space. When it comes from below, when the people invest their own energy to create holiness in this space. That's what endures, and that's what lasts forever. So this is why, when even though everybody saw God at the time of revelation, but yet it was fleeting, because and 40 days later, people were able to do something contrary to what they experienced and what they committed to. Think of when the sun shines into a room and it lights up the room. But is the room itself lit up? No. There's just sunlight that's coming into the room. But when the sun sets, the room is going to go dark. So the room never really became light. It's just that some light was overtaking the space and it lit up the space. But it was something else from the outside overwhelming it. The moment it goes away, there's not going to be any light left in the space. And that is what an experience of seeing God could be potentially. That's all it can be. Seeing God doesn't guarantee belief or compliance. A relationship that is initiated by God, what does that do, or what can happen then? It doesn't really change us. Because just think of that sunlight. It's not changing the space to really make it a lit up space. It happens to be light because the light is entering through the windows or whatever. And therefore it doesn't either last. So this really is the difference in between when something goes from below to above, when we put in our own work, when we put in our own effort, versus when God does everything for us. And in that case, not necessarily will there be anything lasting and taken away from it. Let's read text 5b. And I think we're holding by Sid. Is that correct? But before you actually read it, I just want to make a little note that tonight happens to be the 19th of Kislev on the Hebrew calendar, which is an important date on the Chabad calendar. It's actually called the Rosh Hashanah for Chabad Hasidism and for Chabad philosophy. In a very brief idea, which drives home this point, well, what's the difference, and people ask me this all the time, what's the difference between all the Hasidic movements that we know about in Israel, in Brooklyn, New York, here and there, and Chabad? Is there a difference, and what is the difference? And the difference is going to be summarized in text 5b. Because all the other Hasidic movements, they believe that as long as you have faith in a Rebbe, then as long as he's serving God, and he's righteous, and he's pious, and he's doing it all, then as long as you have faith in the Rebbe and you're connected to him, then he does the work for you and takes you all along. Chabad philosophy is totally different. In fact, if you open up a book of the Rebbe's talks from 1951 and you read his first public address as Rebbe, you know what you're going to find there? He said, I want you to know, he said, in this country, in America, you have to start with a mission statement. And he gave his mission statement, and then he said, I'm going to be here to help, I'll teach, I'll assist, but just know that nobody is getting away without putting the work in on your own. Because that is what Chabad is all about. It's not about someone else doing the work and you going along for the ride. Every individual needs to be empowered to put in their own effort and own initiative. Why? Because that is what endures. When we don't put in the work, when someone else does the work for us, then it may be inspiring. It may last
40 days.
Or maybe a little longer, maybe 80. But ultimately, if I don't own it, it's not mine, then it could just be fleeting. And it won't be there when I'll need it. But when we do put in the work, it's there to stay. Let's go ahead with that short text. Thank you.
We must serve God by our own efforts. Our service is higher when we are led by the hand from above, but it is more precious when it is generated by our own efforts.
Okay, so greater or higher is when God does it. More precious is when we do it. That's what lasts longer. That's what's more valuable. So this is why God generally does not allow himself to be seen, to be visible. Why? Because it's not very useful. Yes, he may do it, but it's not really going to do a whole lot for us unless we put in the work ourselves on our own. So with that, we will real change only happens when it is triggered from within. You know, the Buddhist monk that went over to the vendor and he asked for a hot dog with all the trimmings, and it was $12. The guy gave him a 20, and he's standing there, and the guy is not turning back. He says, what about my change? He says, oh, change. Change has to come from within. And that's really the key. Change has to come from within. If it's being overwhelmed from the outside, we won't have change. Yes?
Yet the most powerful moments in Jewish history initiated by God, when he appears to Abraham, when he appears to Moses, God initiates that.
Excellent question, and for that you have to stick around until question 4 tonight, otherwise known as question 25. Excellent, thank you. So, you know what, one final thought, because one may ask, why would God reveal himself at all if that's the case? Why was there a revelation? Why was there Mount Sinai? Why was there prophecy? And if it was then, why not now? If it was good, let it stick around. If it wasn't, we should never have had it. And the answer is that there's basically, in our relationship with God, we could think of it like a parent and child. When a child is young, first you do everything for the child. You take care of them from A to Z, and you give them everything, and they rely on you for everything. And then every age and phase that they go through, certain aspects are very slowly removed, very slowly, but they are, because the objective is for them to become more independent. So at first, there isn't even any reward and punishment. They get whatever they want. Then you start introducing a little bit of responsibility, and you have to earn things, and then there are consequences, even if, you know, we don't always go about it in the most rigid way, but it exists. And then eventually, they leave the home, and they become more and more independent. First, they go to college. They think they're independent, but they're on your credit card. But then they continue and grow a little older, and they really become independent. So this is similarly with God and the Jewish people. In the earlier phases, in the infancy of the Jewish nation, it was necessary for there to be revelation, because at that stage, God was, so to speak, holding us by the hand and teaching us and guiding us and allowing us to mature. But eventually, once we do mature, then we don't need what we needed at an earlier time when we were, so to speak, in our infancy. So that's why we don't experience it. But on the other hand, as we said, we have a much more valuable and a much deeper, more precious relationship with God because of that. Any quick questions on this before we continue? Okay, so let's advance. So why can't we see God? Because God can't be seen because he wants us to find him. Doesn't want to make it so easy for us. Okay, next question. Can we reconcile God with science? So before we even say a word about this, I want to clarify from the get-go that this isn't a session about trying to reconcile the Torah and science. That needs a course in its own right, at least one course. So we're not gonna walk away from answering this question by everything that we think conflicted between Torah, between Jewish belief and science, that now it's all gonna be aligned. That's not what we're doing here, because obviously it's a much bigger issue and topic, which is way beyond the scope of this lesson and this course. But we're just going to touch on a couple of pointers, a little bit of food for thought on the topic. So let's get a little bit specific. What's the question exactly? So this question has two elements. Number one, do we need God? If somebody is a scientist, let's just say, or if someone has access to science, do they need God altogether at that point? Number two, where's the evidence? So to get a little bit more specific, do we need God? let's say an earlier time when very little science was available. So we understand that then, okay, we needed God much more because we had nowhere else to turn. So anything that was inexplicable, we just said, okay, God. But the more science discovered, the more we know, maybe because we have science, so we need less of God. Or in some cases, we don't even need God anymore. Is that the case? So do we even need God once we have science? And more specifically, the second question, where's the evidence? The question is, if somebody is a scientist and very scientific, could such a person still believe in God? Or if there's no evidence, then they can't even believe in God because they need to view everything from a scientific perspective. Okay, so with that, let's just bring up a couple of points. First question we asked. The first question, do we need God now that we understand so much more about the universe than we did in earlier times? So the main idea is that even if we discovered everything that science has to offer, even if we understood everything about the universe, we would still need God. And why is that? Maybe we wouldn't. But the truth is that science and God are never really in conflict because they are two separate tracks. They're two different things. And we should never think that one, if we have one, it could take the place or makes the other obsolete. Why is that? Because science explores the universe. We understand the world. We understand creation with science. But God, as we know by now from the last 5.5 sessions, that God is beyond the universe. God created the universe. So we're talking about two different tracks. Science understands the universe. God is beyond. He's outside of the universe. He created it. Or in different words, science explains the what, and God tells us why, and gives us the meaning, and gives us the purpose of it all. While science tells us what it is, God helps us understand why it is. Let's read a text from Jonathan Sacks. Text number 7. Larry, you're ready for this one? On page 182, let's see how he puts it.
There is absolutely nothing in science, not in cosmology or evolutionary biology or in neuroscience, to suggest that the universe is bereft of meaning. Nor could there be, since the search for meaning has nothing to do with science and everything to do with religion. Imagine what it would take to explain to someone who had no conception of money what is involved in withdrawing cash from a dispensing machine. He might watch the process 1,000 times, understand precisely the physical properties of the credit card and the dispensing machine, but still have no idea what had taken place. Explaining the transaction might include a history of the division of labor, exchange, barter, and the origins of precious metals as currency, the shift from real to nominal value represented by a banknote, what a bank is, and what deposits, withdrawals, and credits are, and so forth. There is an integral logic of the system, the laws of banking, but the meaning of the system lies elsewhere, and it can only be understood through some sense of wider human context in which it is set. The internal workings of a system do not explain the place the system holds in human lives. Keep going. The meaning of the system lies outside the system. Therefore, the meaning of the universe lies outside the universe. The same is true for science, whose subject is the interrelationship of things within the world, within the natural world. Nature is sublimely indifferent to who we are and what we deserve. There is nothing moral about it. It carries no meaning within it. Science tells us how the parts are related. It cannot tell us what the totality means.
Thank you. So what this tells us is that the scientist needs God, even in the small percentage of the universe that we do understand that science does help us know and understand. Why is that? Because science only explains the physical realm, the physical reality that's observable and measurable, etc. God is not, you can't see God through the magnifying glass. And the same is true for moral values, for meaning, for purpose. And with that, let's go to an illustration of this idea on the screen.
Science and religion. Throughout the centuries, practitioners of both have clashed over perceived contradictions. But is there another way? One in which science and religion are not in competition for ultimate truth? Let's begin with a poem, Binging by Dr. Seuss. I can watch that show some other day, I thought I'd say. I have plenty of time to watch that show, I thought I'd go. I can take a break right now, I thought I'd vow. But then I thought, but then I thought, but then I thought, why not watch that show right now? Of course, Theodore Seuss Geisel never lived to see the dawn of binge-watching. This plausible fabrication was created in under 3 seconds by an artificial intelligence called GPT-3 at the prompting of a New Yorker magazine staff writer who asked the AI to write a Dr. Seuss poem about binge-watching Netflix.
I would say that it is a general purpose language tool. So you can give it a problem statement, or you can give it a what we call a prompt. All of what it's doing is looking at a sequence of words, basically, and trying to predict the ones that should come next. But to do that well, it has to sort of understand the structure and what a human would think would come next. It's trained on looking at lots of text and predicting what would come next.
The next time the topic of AI comes up over dinner, you can explain how, in response to write a joke about a rabbi giving a sermon on Shabbat, GPT-3 can calmly spit out, because it was the day of rest. But knowing how something works is only half the equation. There is an entirely different set of questions that need to be answered before you begin prodding the robot, such as, why are you turning to AI? Are you writing speaker bios or blog posts? Do you want to simplify and summarize a complex text for third graders? Or are you trying to generate new, creative app ideas? Knowing how the text is processed and then predicted does not help you answer any of these questions. Technical knowledge will not help you generate a good prompt. Here's how the late rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks put it.
Science takes things apart to see how they work. Religion puts things together to see what they mean. And we need them both, the way we need the two hemispheres of the brain. One way of seeing the difference is to think about their relationship with time. Science looks for causes of events, and a cause always comes before its effect. How did the window break? Because I threw a stone at it. First came the throwing of the stone, then came the breaking of the window. Science looks back from effect to cause. However, human action is always looking forward. Why did I throw the stone? Because I wanted to wake someone who is asleep to warn them that the building next door is on fire. And action always seeks to bring about something in the future.
Science takes things apart to see how they work. Religion puts things together to see what they mean. Science may tell us how this universe works, but only divine wisdom and creativity can prompt us to write a life story filled with joy, creativity, purpose, and meaning.
Okay, so as far as our second point, if somebody is a scientist and they are scientific, could they still believe in God? So there were many scientists over the years who took the approach that if they are scientific and they need evidence for everything, then they can't believe in God. But at the same time, there were many, as long as they don't want to let go of their faith in God, they absolutely don't need to, and they could maintain and preserve their faith in God. And why is that? Because, as we said, These are two different tracks. These are two different things. With one, we understand the world, and with one, we understand the meaning behind the world, the why of the universe, the why of life, and that infuses meaning and purpose into life. So where's the evidence? God created the laws of nature. A different system is needed to explore God. The believer's faith is enhanced by science. So let's close out this topic with text number 9. Lynn, please. This is from Rabbi Avraham Cook. More modern day rabbi. Lynn, please.
With the recognition of existence comes an enduring recognition of and reverence for God. The persistence of natural law tells of the wisdom and greatness of the Creator. In the words of the prophet, lift up your eyes and see who created these. Isaiah 40:26. Therefore, it is fitting for every wise-hearted person to draw waters of reverence from the precious spring of existence, for it all expresses honor to its Creator.
Thank you. So the truth is that the more we appreciate the world through science, the more you're able to appreciate it, the Creator of the universe. So actually studying science could help you come to an even greater recognition and awe of God Almighty. So we'll advance to our next question. And that is question number 3 for tonight. Why is Judaism so obsessed with idolatry? Is God jealous or something? How many mitzvahs are there in the Torah?
613.
How many of them, if you don't know, you can guess, how many of them are addressing idolatry?
At least one.
One.
That's a good answer.
Anyone else?
More than one.
62. Any other wild guesses? Okay, well, Shelby was close. 51. 51 out of 613 are about idolatry. That must mean that the Jews have this craze for idolatry. Not only the Jews do, but God is so intimidated by the Jews being obsessed with idolatry. And why is it? Was he lacking the confidence that people will just believe in him? I mean, think of the first two commandments. There were only 10 commandments that we heard from God, as we mentioned before. Yet, 2 out of 10, what was the first? I am the Lord your God. And the second one is no other gods. So 2 out of the first 10 are already addressing the fact that you should believe in one God and no other gods. So we have to understand what is the deal with that. You know where the word Jew comes from, by any chance?
Judah.
From Yehuda. Judah. Yehuda. What does that mean? What does the word mean? Yehudi in Hebrew is Jew, right? The Talmud tells us that the name Yehudi is someone who acknowledges God. The word Yehuda is to acknowledge. And it means that we acknowledge God and we also reject anyone, anything else, or any other entity outside of God. So again, it's right there in the name, and we have to understand why is this so central, such a dominant topic, and covers so many of the commandments. We may want to say, if we want to go even further, what's wrong with more than one God anyway? And if one God is good, then why can't you have more of a good thing? What's so terrible? Let's go beyond that. So first of all, there are many biblical prohibitions that relate to idolatry. So is God jealous? What's the significance of having one God? And if 51 of the commandments are about not worshiping idols, and raise your hand if you had a desire in the last 30 days to worship an idol.
Not so much.
Nobody did. So are you telling me that 51 of the commandments are not even relevant nowadays? Not one person in this room. So if we, in all likelihood, if we added people to the room, it would still remain at zero.
Look at the statue pullover.
So that means it's got to be, it seems to be, not relevant. But the truth is that we will discover what faith in God really means and what idolatry really means, and then everything will make sense. So with that, let's go to a short text, text number 11. Yana, would you like to read that one for us, please? It's from Maimonides.
The early sages taught getting angry is tantamount to idolatry.
Ooh, anger is like worshiping idols. Now it's going like beyond the 51. If somebody gets angry, it's like they worshiped idols. How would you, I mean, nobody's going to say that anger is a good thing, but why would anger be like worshiping idols? Anybody?
You put yourself above everything else, right? It's self-centered.
Self-centered, self, forgetting about God. We're getting there. Yes, correct. So let's understand this a little bit more. How is getting angry like idolatry? So for that, we're going to visit with a fascinating story that happened with King David. It's in our next text. And what happened here, just a little bit of the backdrop, was during a rebellion rebellion of King David's son by the name of Absalom. So David was on the run, and this following story happened right then. So during this trying time, David chanced upon somebody. This somebody's name was Shimi ben Gera. That's his name, and the story is in the prophets. And this Shimi ben Gera sees King David, and he starts to pelt him with stones, and he was cursing at him, at King David. So Avishai, who is King David's devoted lieutenant, says to the king, says to David, you're just going to take that from him? You're going to let him do this to you? To curse you and throw these stones at you, and you're just going to take it quietly? This is what's going on here. So let's take a look at 12a. Vlad, please.
Abishai, son of Zeruiah, said to the king, why allow this dead dog to curse my lord the king? Let me go over and take off his head.
Keep going.
The king responded, what is it between me and you, sons of Zeruiah? Let him curse, for God has told him to curse David. Who then has the right to say, why have you done so?
Thank you. Something very powerful, very profound was being communicated here by David. So his lieutenant told him, why are you taking that from him? Let me go handle him. What did the king say? That it's not Shimi who's cursing me. It's God who's speaking through him. It's not him. I should get angry at him. If this is happening to me, means that it was orchestrated by God himself. Shimi, who is the one who's the mouthpiece that's actually delivering the words or the curses, he's just a messenger. It's not about him. It's coming from God. If I'm hearing it, that means God wants me to hear it. So if I unleash my anger at him, what's happening here? Basically, I'm denying the fact that it was God doing it. If I'm giving Shimi the credit for doing it, and therefore I'm going to get angry at him, in other words, what am I saying? That Shimi is the one that did it, not God. So here we begin to understand why anger is like idolatry. It's like worshiping idols. Because if I'm getting angry at somebody for something, or for anything that happened. I got a flat tire when I was on my way to a meeting, and it ruined my day. If I'm getting angry, that means I am giving credit to something outside of God for ruining my day. If God did it, then there's nothing to get angry about, because then you know that it was supposed to happen. If it came from God, then this is exactly what needed to happen and what's supposed to happen. So why would you get angry? If I'm getting angry, it means that I'm giving credit to something or someone outside of God. And the moment I give credit to something outside of God, that is a subtle form of idolatry because I'm adding value or attributing value to something outside of God, just like anyone back in the day who used to worship an idol. What were they doing? They were saying that this idol has, why am I worshiping the idol? Why did they? Because they thought it has powers and it makes decisions for them, whether it was the sun or the moon or the rain or the cloud, etc., etc. What did they think? They thought that by worshiping that particular thing or even a statue, they thought that they would get something out of it. When we attribute value to something outside of God, that is a subtle form of idolatry because we're saying that God isn't in control here. If I'm getting angry at that person, in other words, I'm saying that they are in control of what just happened to me, not God. Yes, Lou.
So if Shimei cursed David and David said that it was really God and not Shimei, isn't that a contradiction of free will?
It's not, and we discussed this last week already. So as far as David's concerned, he only has to deal with God. The fact that God chose to communicate that through Shimei, does that mean that Shimei is not responsible for his actions? If he's just acting as an agent of God, does that mean that he's not liable for pelting somebody with stones or cursing at somebody? No, it doesn't. He absolutely is. Because God needed an agent to carry out that mission for him. But Shimei offered his services. And in doing so, he made himself liable for making a bad choice. He didn't have to do it. God needed this to get done. Through who? God has his ways. The fact that he offered himself up to be the one to communicate that, for that he gets punished. Just because God needed it to happen doesn't mean he needed him to do it. Am I making sense?
I'm struggling with this.
It's definitely a big idea, but at least I want to make sure that we understand it. Let's read Joyce.
Well, it's like if someone crashes into you and you get, you know, terribly injured, you're paralyzed, you know, God meant that person to crash into you and you're paraplegic because of it.
This definitely brings up some other topics that we talked about in some of the other classes about how things that seem bad to us, how do we attribute them to God? Let's just take for granted, and again, it does bring up some emotional issues, and it usually ends up about the Holocaust itself. But let's just say that in Jewish belief, there's nothing that happens in the world that is not orchestrated by God. We're gonna take that approach. If that's the case, then if something happens to me, and if I'm getting angry at that person, I'm basically saying that God wasn't in control. Because if he was, why am I getting angry at said individual?
That is hard to deal with on big scale, violent, horrific things.
And you know what? For each individual person,
yeah,
it's hard to deal with things that happen in their own life.
Sure.
What happens to one individual is as severe as something that happens on a large scale. It's just volume, but it's the same concept. It's the same struggle. Let's take a look at text 12b from Rabbi Shmuel Zalman of the Adi. Manny, I think you're up.
Our sages equate anger to idolatry. The reason for this is clear to those who have understanding. Because at the time of anger, a person's faith in God departs. For if one believed that what happened to them was God's doing, they would not be angry at all. Granted, a person with free will cursed or struck or caused damage to the property of the victim, and for their evil choice, they are liable for punishment. In a court of law, as well as in the heavenly court. Nevertheless, heaven has already decreed that this incident befell the person who was harmed, and God has many agents through whom he can act.
Thank you. So what do we have here? Getting angry is tantamount to idolatry. As we said, it sounds a bit extreme. We talked about Shimei and King David. Shimei ben Gera pelted King David with stones and cursed him. Avishai, David's lieutenant, wanted to take action, and David said, "Let him curse, for God has told him to curse. And if it's coming from God, then let it be. It's not Shimei who's cursing me, it's God. Shimei is just a tool. If it's from God, that means it was supposed to happen. That's the key. If it's coming from God, then we know that that's exactly what needed to happen. Anger is a denial of God and his benevolence. It puts the power into someone else's hands, and this creates an idol. So we asked, is idol worship irrelevant nowadays? Because who's attracted to worshiping a statue or a figure? And the answer was nobody. But the truth is, when we reframe our understanding of what faith in God is, and when we get angry, when we get angry, what we're doing is attributing control to something outside of God. That is like idolatry. And if that's the case, then we are at risk of idolatry almost at any moment, because all of us attribute some power to various different things in our life. We attribute our happiness to certain things, sometimes to certain people, sometimes to our boss, sometimes to money. Sometimes we worship our self-image or various other things that we think that our happiness comes from. So if it's coming from something and not from God, that means that that is a subtle form of idolatry. So let's just close this off, and I'll take a question or two. The prohibition against idolatry cuts to the very heart of Judaism, and that's because, do I believe in God and his total control over this world? That's the question we need to ask ourselves. So why is Judaism so obsessed with idolatry? And we asked if God is jealous. And the answer is that placing one's trust in anything other than God's absolute control is the essence of idolatry. Yes?
So if you get anger, isn't that also sort of in God's control? And as a follow-up question, anger seems to be a motivating factor for justice. Somebody does something unjust, you get angry about the injustice of it all and want to correct it, hold that person accountable. And that, you know, it's sort of like lust and procreation. Without lust, there might not be much procreation. Without anger, would there be justice?
Okay, so first thing first. What was the first thing?
Anger preceding justice. Anger,
before that,
God control anger. Your anger.
If God, so we already established in previous classes that when it comes to our moral choices, we are 100% in control. God is in control of everything. He sides for our moral choices. Over there, I think we had a question that was about control, or was it about? We came to the conclusion that God controls everything, but the only thing he empowered us with where we have control, or where he can't control us, I think that's how it was put, when it comes to our choices. So yes, it's our own choice. And as far as it having a positive, I don't know if we can say that idolatry has any positive, although you have a point, but I don't know if anger is necessary. We have different emotions. We have kindness, but we also have discipline. So discipline and justice, definitely. Anger, by definition, means that we are, as was noted before, that we are losing control of ourselves. Our emotions are getting the better of us. We also talked about the fact that God, why does God become angry? We dealt with in one of the lessons. And over there we said that God controls his anger, not his anger controlling him. He is a God of anger, Kael Kana, which means that he controls it, he uses it. In that case, you may have a point. The question is, if we're getting angry, so if we're controlling our anger and we're just using it for a specific purpose, then I think we shouldn't even call it anger, because it's only anger when it's controlling us. When we're controlling it, we're not really angry. We're just utilizing our an attribute of judgment, of justice, of discipline, in order to
a motivation
to respond to the, it's how we respond to the anger.
Exactly, but we're in control. Sometimes you have to sound very strict to your child, but you turn around and you smile because you were just using it. You didn't really lose yourself. You just needed to sound strict, or you needed to set down the law, and you did. But the moment you walked out of the room, you're not lost. You didn't lose your cool. That's not okay, ever.
Is righteous indignation different than anger? Meaning, are there different words in Hebrew to describe an emotion of being upset?
I mean, there's sadness in Hebrew, you know, atzvut, yeah, which is a very negative trait, but we're not going to get into it right now. Did you have a?
I was just thinking, like, what about hatred of, you know, people against other people?
Hatred is almost never okay. The only thing we should hate is evil. Not because we should be busy hating evil. We should be busy loving goodness. The flip side of loving goodness is that we also despise evil. But we shouldn't spend our time despising evil. We should spend our time focusing on loving what's good.
Right, but I'm thinking of it in context of, you know, Israel and Palestinians and the hatred of the people because of religion. Where does that... No.
I don't think anybody hates anyone because of their religion. If they hate, it's because somebody's trying to kill you. But we're not going to be addressing this topic tonight. It's a course in its own right. We don't want anybody getting angry. Okay, final question. Final question and course conclusion after the question. And that is, why do I need to follow the Torah system to have a relationship with God? So many people, you know, when we're 15 years old, we're already sent out onto the streets to sell Judaism. And we approach people and ask someone on Fifth Avenue to wrap tefillin, or we offer Shabbat candles to a woman. And sometimes they'll say, well, I'm a Jew at heart. I'm very spiritual. I don't need to actually do that mitzvah. Maybe they're right. Why do I have to follow a system in order to have a relationship with God? Can't I just have my own relationship and define it how I like to define it? So, we already talked about this in one of our lessons, that Judaism is not a religion per se. What it is a relationship with God. Judaism is defined by having a relationship with God. It's a way to connect to God. It's a way to have a relationship with God. But it's not a... So the question is, if we need a religious system. So we open this course with Abraham. We're going to close the course with Abraham. And that is that in the beginning we talked about Abraham being a serving as a salesman for his father in his idol shop. And we talked about an episode there. But let's read what happened before that and what happened after that. We're at 13a. Erica, would you like to read? Okay. This is Maimonides, written about 850 years ago.
After his mighty person in Abraham was weaned, he began to ponder deeply. Though he was a young child, he began to contemplate by day and by night. He had no teacher, nor was there anyone to inform him. Rather, he mirrored in Ur-Kasdim's population of foolish idolaters. His father, mother, and all the people around him worshipped idols. He would worship along with them. But his heart was busy analyzing everything, and he gained a clear understanding. Ultimately, he arrived at the true way and understood the path of righteousness Through his accurate comprehension, he realized that there was one God, and he created everything, and that there was no one other than God among all that existed.
Thank you. So this is the beginning of Abraham's story, how he came to the conclusion on his own, with nobody supporting him. He discovered it on his own that there's one God and there's only one God worthy of believing. It was at this point in his story that that story with the idol shop happened. And then what happens after that? What happens after that is 13b. Dan, would you please read that for us?
Abraham used his recognition and knowledge of the Creator to formulate presentations for the population of Ur Pasdim and to debate them, informing them that they were not following the true path. When he won them over with the strength of his arguments, the king desired to execute him. His life was spared through a miracle, and he relocated to Haran. He then began a public campaign, loudly proclaiming to all humanity and informing them that in all the universe there is but one God, and that it is appropriate to worship him alone. He traveled to publicize his message everywhere, rallying people in city after city, kingdom after kingdom. When the people would rally to him, questioning him regarding his statements, he would explain to each individual, according to their understanding, until he had brought that individual back to the true path. Eventually, tens of thousands rallied around Abraham. They are the folk referred to in the Torah as the people of the house of Abraham, in whose hearts he firmly planted this great fundamental principle.
Thank you. Dan, what an incredible resume Abraham has. So we now know his whole early life. He realized that there was one God. Abraham then convinced tens of thousands of people of this truth. And now is the big question. When you open up the Bible and start reading about Abraham, what is the first thing you read about? Anyone know? It's the opening of the Torah portion called Lech Lecha. How does it open?
He was a stranger.
To move, to go. Lech Lecha, you should start moving. Go, leave the house of your father, your land, your birthplace, and go to the land that I will show you. How old was Abraham when he got this commandment?
75.
Thank you. You nailed it this time. If that's the case, if he was 75, where is his whole early life in the Bible? Now we know this from the oral tradition. It's written up in the Midrash and the Talmud, but the Bible itself gives us nothing about Abraham's early life. He comes onto the scene at age 75 with the commandment that you are to leave your father's home and go to the land that I will show you. And we're talking about not just petty information, we're talking about perhaps the greatest resume ever to be written since the beginning of humanity for one individual to create such a revolution. And yet it goes totally silent. We know nothing of it just from reading the Bible. Without reading the other books, we wouldn't know about this. It starts at age 75. That is the big question. Why does the Torah itself omit his entire early life? Tells us nothing about him. By the way, we have another instance where something, at least something, is told about somebody who comes onto the scene. And that's Noah. We at least have a couple of lines. We have, and Noah found favor in the eyes of God. We know that Noah was righteous, tzaddik, tamim. He was sincere, wholesome. He was righteous. And then starts the story of Noah and his family and then the flood. But at least we get a few words of why God chose him, because he was a righteous man. About Abraham, we don't get a word. He comes onto the scene. Of course, we know that he was born. We know his lineage. That's it. Nothing about him until this commandment. Why is that? And the answer is going to be something transformative when it comes to understanding the very essence of Judaism. And we're at text 14b. Alan, could you please read that for us?
The Torah emphasizes at the very beginning of the Jewish story in the narrative of Abraham what makes a Jew unique. Abraham's uniqueness as a Jew and his elevated stature do not begin with his extraordinary qualities, with the closeness to God that he achieved through his own toil and efforts, but rather God said to Abraham, "Go forth." It begins with God setting Abraham apart. Abraham's relationship with and attachment to God was established through God commanding him and his fulfillment of that command.
Thank you. So here is the secret and of the very essence of Judaism. Everything Abraham did until age 75 was his own doing. He searched, he discovered, he taught, he shared, was all him. He started it. What happened at the age of 75 was the first time that God revealed himself to him and communicated to him something. So where does Judaism start? Judaism starts when God tells us what our next move needs to be. In other words, when you want to enter a relationship with somebody, I could think that, you know, if I mean, talk about in a marriage or in any relationship. So you want to do something nice for the other. So let's say I want to buy flowers for my wife. The problem is she doesn't really care for flowers. I'm just giving an example. I'm not really sure if my wife does or doesn't. Maybe I should know by now. Let's say, what's that? A few years. So
not long enough.
Yeah.
Apparently.
But let's just say somebody's spouse doesn't care for flowers. But I'm gonna get them flowers because I think that they should like flowers. Am I going to be strengthening the bond? Not at all. Because I'm doing it on my terms, not on their terms. If somebody wants to meet me and I say, well, I'm gonna be at this bowling alley, and they tell me they're going to be at this and this lounge. Okay, you can go to where you want to go, but I'm not going to be there. That's where you want to hang out. But if you want to see me, that's not where I'm going to be. So when it comes to a relationship with God, many people have great ideas of how they want to worship God. And many want to just feel like they feel connected to God. They want to feel spiritual. And they have ways of how they like to feel spiritual. But if these ways were not established by God, who we're in a relationship with, then it's just a mismatch. It's not bad, but it has nothing to do with the relationship. So the Torah is trying to make a very powerful point here. Yes, Abraham achieved incredible things, like nobody else before him and after him, in the first 75 years of his life. But what is Judaism? Judaism starts not by what we think we are doing for God. It may be correct, it may not be correct, but it has to be on God's terms. Because who can even establish a relationship between creator and creation, between God and a human being? There's no way for us to bridge that gap. We can try and try and try, but it will just keep bringing us back to zero. Because even if you add many, many zeros to many, many zeros, it's still going to be zero. But God himself is the only one who's able to bridge the gap between creator and creation. So when God does that, that is where the beginning of Judaism is. So the beginning of Abraham's life, what is this? Anyone? Anyone?
What? Anyone what, Rabbi?
I don't know. Let me see. Anyway, it's frozen. So the beginning of Abraham's life was all his own doing. But when it comes to his age of 75, that was God's commandment, and that changed the relationship. And the relationship starts with God, and that is the essence of Judaism, and this brings us to the answer to our question. What was our question? Why is it necessary to follow a system in order to be in a relationship with God? And the answer is that God decides what relationship he wants to be in and the terms of the relationship. Only God could decide what the terms are. If we want to be in a relationship with God, it has to be on his terms. And that is the magic of the 613 commandments. That's the magic of a mitzvah. Every time we do a mitzvah, what are we really saying? God reached out to me, wants to be in a relationship, told me how I can be in a relationship, and when I'm doing that mitzvah, we are now officially in a relationship. So in summation, the Torah is not a system, rather it's a framework that that contains 613 ladders or rungs in a ladder, each of them leading to a stronger, deeper relationship with God. So, okay, maybe we saved it. Not quite. Any technical pro here to get us moving again? If not, it's not the biggest deal. But with that, we're going to advance to the course conclusion, and. Whatever, I mean, we were basically at the end, but I guess you...
Do you have a pointer or something? Hold on a second.
I don't think it's going to be... I would just leave it. Just don't worry about it.
Okay.
We're basically at the end. I can do without it.
Okay.
So with this, we arrive at the conclusion of our six-week journey and fascinating exploration. What I'm going to do before we actually close is... I'm going to ask each of you here to please be a little bit brave, and I want to ask everyone around the table to share just one thing that was most powerful for you or personally relevant for you that's the takeaway from this course. Try to be a little specific beyond just that it strengthened your faith or your knowledge. Try to identify one idea that was personally relevant to you. And the purpose of it, first of all, is for each of us to be able to take something home. But I think in the process, we're going to be inspiring each other as well. So I need somebody to go first. And while somebody's going first, everyone else is going to be able to think about things.
I'll go first.
Yana,
yeah,
go ahead.
So I think a few weeks ago when you were talking about, like, is it okay to question God and then are you Jewish or not, you know, question. We're talking about that. I think that really resonated with me, coming from, like, I was born in the former Soviet Union, and so obviously we didn't practice a lot of religion, and so growing up in our home, I was always taught, hey, be proud of your Judaism, know your Judaism, but it's not about being religious or going to synagogue. So I think, and it kind of brought things back full circle to what I always kind of heard, and hearing it from you and saying, hey, that's okay, like, that is part of your Judaism, that it's not, I think, you know, we get caught up sometimes in what formal religion is, you know, what that definition is, and I think, so that was really powerful for me in hearing it come from you.
Excellent, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Next, Alan.
Tonight, when we were talking about getting angry is like idolatry, I think, aside from the motivating anger, that can be positive. If you succumb to it and you're basically, your yates are awry, your amygdala is taking over your brain and you're not actually in your right mind, so I can see that resonated. And then when something bad happens, rather than being angry at the person, if you think of it as this is part of the plan, the message take home is whatever you can control, what's in your control, is what you should focus on. And the concept where the obstacle is the way, you know, how you react and respond to a situation is much more important than getting angry, for instance. So focus on what you can control.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Somebody else was ready to go? Everyone's going to have to say something. It's just a question of the order. Larry.
Well, this course clarified to me, the universe versus God. I had trouble thinking beyond the universe until this course.
Okay, wonderful. That God is transcends creation, nature, the universe. Lynn, do you want to say something?
Probably it was very similar to when we're talking about idolatry and how that term, because, you know, traditionally, I think it's all worshiping statues and idols and whatever, and the different just semantics of it. But I mean, it's it kind of comes in another door for me, because we all know people who harbor anger for a long time. I mean, we can be quick to anger, but then we can deal with it. But people who keep that anger inside, we know how that destroys people's lives.
Long-term idolatry.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Sid, please.
So I think the biggest revelation to me is how this course opened up my thinking with my relationship with God in terms of father-child, or as this course said, husband-wife, which I thought was a much more powerful relationship, because there's great respect and love and devotion in marriage, maybe not so much in father-child. There's honor and respect, but maybe not so much love and devotion.
So the parent-child relationship. Yeah, that's great. Thank you for sharing that. Nick, you had something?
Just this duality. There seems to be a lot of duality occupying the same space at the same time. Like, what did you call it? Midas Hadin or Midas Rachamam or Rachamim or something?
Rachamim?
Yeah. The merciful and forgiveness of misdeeds, but at the same time, these particular misdeeds require consequences. But I see this duality pattern that kind of exists throughout the whole thing.
Yeah, last week we discussed that a lot. Lou, please.
Two things, if I can. One is that I think part of what we're supposed to do is to struggle with a lot of answers and ask a lot of questions, some of which we may come to some conclusion of an answer and some may not, about the nature of God and other things as well. The other thing is that as a scientifically trained person, I have always, hate to use that word, but I think it's relevant in this case, not had a conflict between science and religion. And the discussion tonight kind of reinforced that a little bit. I've always wondered why some scientists feel that they have to have a scientific answer to the why, which there is no scientific answer to the why.
Thank you. Joyce?
Agreeing with Lou, I have a very good friend who is like, there is no God, there's no evidence for God, so there can't be a God. And I still have a lot of questions, unfortunately, I missed 2 weeks because I was sick. But one thing that helped me was the discussion on good and evil, and that for goodness to exist and for us to see it, there had to be evil, because that's always been such a question for me, of why do these things happen? And
the balance is necessary.
The duality, like he talked about as well.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for sharing that. Dan, please.
As someone who didn't grow up Jewish, I think the biggest takeaway for me was getting a much better appreciation of the relationship between God and all of existence, you know, as opposed to sort of this bearded character, you know, in heaven who sits in judgment of us. It was an eye-opener for me.
Okay, that's great. Lucy, please.
Well, I grew up Seventh-day Adventist, and I enjoy everything you've been teaching us, and I've been learning much more about Judaism. And I think what I like the most is like when you mentioned that everything's happened in your life has a reason. That you should not get angry, should not get mad, because God has a plan. And it's happened because he's looking out the best for you. And I enjoy your classes very much.
Thank you.
Looking forward to the next.
Thank you for mentioning that. So, one second, Vlad, please.
My turn. I've learned that in Judaism there are 10 more questions for every answer. I also enjoy the concept that, you know, God is everywhere, and I think the class where we discussed the concept of, do you have to believe in God to be Jewish, and the definition of Jewish soul was very powerful to me, kind of similar to Yana, not, you know, growing up in former Soviet Union, not being able to really learn anything about Judaism or go to synagogue, but yet having a Jewish soul, like, so to me that resonated.
Yeah, much, thank you for sharing that. Manny or Erica, you want to share something?
Unless I'm mistaken, and also the reason why I come to this course is to see how JLI would attempt to tackle the problem of expressing in human terms, in physical terms, the impossibility of understanding God.
Yeah.
And it was a stark effort, and that's it.
Okay, I think we established that, and we did our best to be able to discuss within the non-discussable. Is that it? Anyone else? Shelby.
I think it's nice to know that God needs us.
Yes, that's a big one in Judaism, because if he doesn't need us, he wouldn't have created us. If he created us, it's because we're all here for a purpose. So I just want to close with this thought. There was a very famed yeshiva, a school in Poland, called the Yeshiva Chachmei Lublin. And it was headed by Rabbi Meir Shapiro, very well known before the war. And he would travel a lot to solicit support for his school. And he would come to a community and lecture and speak. And the whole community would come. And that would be a way for him to generate support to bring back home. He did so in one community. He gave a lecture, all the scholars of the town came to hear him, and he did a fantastic job as usual. When he finished, people huddled together to start discussing his innovative ideas and his novel Torah thoughts that he presented. One guy, a simple fellow, approaches the rabbi, and he says, "Rabbi, I have to be honest, I didn't really understand much of what you said, but I do want to write a check to support your school." So the rabbi says to him, "I want you to know that actually you are the only one that understood what I said." I'm telling the story not because anybody here is asking for a check. Rather, because we studied for 6 weeks, six sessions, a lot of big ideas, as we just heard so many of you sharing and exchanging. But the key to all of it is, what are we doing with this new information? How are we bringing this all into practice? What is that one aspect of Judaism, that one mitzvah perhaps, that is going to be that manifestation, if you will, of actualizing all the great ideas that we learned together? So I want to challenge you to reflect on that, identify something, bring it into your life, and then it was all absolutely worth it. Final thought, two pieces of business.